So here we are on page 169, which is chapter 6, the essence of the sacrifice 2, paragraph 15. We are nowadays only in three. So I see Andrea, me, and John Robert as sequence. Should we make a short meditation?
Yeah, I just want to mention that the second paragraph is two full pages, and the third paragraph is 2.5 pages. We might want to break those up because that's a very long reading for one person.
Which are the so this paragraph I have counted 16. 16, yeah. So that on page 170, you mean? This object of the integral yoga must be accepted.
Right, yeah. That's two full pages.
We can...
Maybe we just do one page and then skip, then go to the next person.
Yeah, we can divide it up into two parts. I would say, it is the soul of human or titanic desire. Yeah, they see Titanic. I saw the word Titanic. It catched my eye. It is on page 170 in the middle, more or less. So we can stop there and give.
Yeah, let's just be spontaneous about it because I can't find what you're seeing.
A bit. Okay.
I see. Yes, I see it. Yeah.
When the word Titanic comes up.
Yeah.
The one gives the goes Good. Over to gives out to the other the prison the reading. Okay.
So does somebody have a bell? Because my bell is not working very well, and Jeffrey was doing that online for the meditation to start.
Not really a bell, but
I have one. I'll get it. It's right behind me here in the closet.
Okay. It's better than a glass of water. But let me see if it works.
No.
It's also full of water, so it's because I like to drink when after eating. Okay.
Actually, a bowl.
Into the third and last category of the works of sacrifice can be gathered all that is directly proper to the yoga of works. For here is its field of effectuation and major province. It covers the entire range of life's more visible activities. Under it fall the multiform energies of the will to life, throwing itself outward to make the most of material existence. It is here that an ascetic or otherworldly spirituality feels an insurmountable denial of the truth which it seeks after, and is compelled to turn away from terrestrial existence, rejecting it as forever the dark playground of an incurable ignorance. Yet it is precisely these activities that are claimed for a spiritual conquest and divine transformation by the integral yoga. Abandoned altogether by the more ascetic disciplines, accepted by others only as a field of temporary ordeal or a momentary, superficial, and ambiguous play of the concealed spirit, this existence is fully embraced and welcomed by the integral seeker as a field of fulfillment, a field for divine works, a field of total self-discovery of the concealed and indwelling spirit. The discovery of the divinity in oneself is his first object, but a total discovery too of the divinity in the world, behind the apparent denial offered by its scheme and figures, and last, a total discovery of the dynamism of some transcendent eternal. For by its descent, this world and self will be empowered to break their disguising envelopes and become divine in revealing form and manifesting process as they now are secretly in their hidden essence.
This object of the integral yoga must be accepted wholly by those who follow it, but the acceptance must not be in ignorance of the immense stumbling blocks that lie in the way of the achievement. On the contrary, we must be fully aware of the compelling cause of the refusal of so many other disciplines to regard even its possibility, much less its imperative character, as a true meaning of terrestrial existence. For here in the works of life, in the earth nature, is the very heart of the difficulty that has driven philosophy to its hates of aloofness and turned away even the eager eye of religion from the malady of birth in a mortal body to a distant paradise or a silent peace of nirvana. A way of pure knowledge is comparatively straightforward and easy to the threat of the seeker in spite of our mental limitations and the pitfalls of the ignorance. A way of pure love, although it has its stumbling blocks and its sufferings and trials, can in comparison be as easy as the winging of a bird through the free azure. For knowledge and love are pure in their essence and become mixed and embarrassed, corrupted and degraded only when they enter into the ambiguous movement of the life forces and are seized by them for the outward life's crude movements and obstinately inferior motives. Alone of the three powers of life, or at least a certain predominant will in life, has the appearance of something impure, accursed or fallen in its very essence. At its contact, wrapped in its dull sheets or caught in its iridescence quagmires, that the divinities themselves become common and muddy and hardly escape from being dragged downwards into its perversions and disastrously assimilated to the demon and the azure. A principle of dark and dull inertia is as its base. All are tried down by the body and its needs and desires to a trivial mind petty desires and emotions, and insignificant repetitions of small, worthless functionings, needs, cares, occupations, pains, pleasures that lead to nothing beyond themselves, and bear the stamp of an ignorance that knows not its own why and whither. This physical mind of inertia believes in no divinity other than its own small earth gods. It aspires perhaps to a greater comfort, order, pleasure, but asks for no uplifting and no spiritual deliverance. At the center, we meet a stronger will of life with a greater gusto, but it is a blinded demon, a perverted spirit, and exults in the very elements that make of life a striving turmoil and an unhappy imbroglio. So here we have, it is a soul of human or titanic desire, clinging to the garish color, disordered poetry, violent tragedy, or stirring melodrama of this mixed flux of good and evil, joy and sorrow, light and darkness, heady rapture and bitter torture. I can finish this paragraph. It works. It loves these things and would have more and more of them, or even when it suffers and cries out against them, can accept or joy in nothing else. It hates and revolts against higher things, and in its fury would trample, tear, or crucify any diviner power that has the presumption to offer to make life pure, luminous, and happy, and snatch from its lips the fiery brew of that exciting mixture. Another will in life there is that another will in life there is ready to follow the ameliorating ideal mind and is allured by its offer to extract some harmony, beauty, light, nobler order out of life. But this is a smaller part of the vital nature and can be easily overpowered by its more violent or darker, duller joke comrades. Nor does it readily lend itself to a call higher than that of the mind unless that call defeats itself, as religion usually does, by lowering its demand to conditions more intelligible to our obscure vital nature. All these forces the spiritual seeker grows aware of in himself and finds all around him has to struggle and combat incessantly to be rid of their grip and dislodge the long entrenched mastery they have exercised over his own being as over the environing human existence. The difficulty is great, for their hold is so strong, so apparently invincible, that it justifies that disdainful dictum which compares human nature to a dog's tail. For straighten it never so much by force of ethics, religion, reason, or any other redemptive effort, it returns in the end always to the crooked curl of nature. And so great is the whim, the clutch of that more agitated life will, so immense the peril of its passions and errors, so subtly insistent or persistently invasive, so obstinate up to the very gates of heaven, the fury of its attacks or the tedious obstruction of its obstacles that even the saint and the yogin cannot be sure of their liberated purity or their trained self-mastery against its intrigue or its violence. All labor to straighten out this native crookedness strikes the struggling will as a futility, a flight, a withdrawal to happy heaven, or peaceful dissolution, easily finds credit as the only wisdom and to find a way not to be born again gets established as the only remedy for the dull bondage of the poor, shoddy delirium, or the blinded and precarious happiness and achievement of earthly existence. I managed it to go through at the end.
It would really be better not to read two pages with one voice, because yeah. I lose connection. You know, when we change voice, something fresh happens again. So, yeah. But thank you for that.
Especially when you have my accent and my a perfect reading. But yeah. I would also suggest eventually, not now, but when we have finished the whole chapter, to read this again, not phrase by phrase, but piece by piece, because here's so much here, I think. So a lot of stuff is in here that relates to our everyday life, I think also. It is every sentence seems to be exaggerated, and maybe also, and I'm not sure Sherwin would write it in the same way today, because we have a very different context nowadays, 100 years later. But the essence, what is the essence of this? How do we relate to this?
And that's very difficult it is, has been for humanity to rise above this small mind and the small life.
Yeah, I think it's here it's more the life, also the mind, of course. But yeah. Here he's speaking more about the life and the emotions and mm-hmm. our appetites and our and a lot of things. Yeah, here I think. Yes. What does he mean really? How? For who is a blinded demon and perverted spirit? What is he talking about? Is this something that we are the good guys, you know? So it doesn't relate to us. That has nothing to do with us, no? Right? I'm not so sure about that. It would be interesting to go deeper into this paragraph. Well, but anyway,
we can do it now. We don't have to wait. It sounds like you're all loaded for discussion on this, so let's go for it.
I don't know if you two also agree, but I don't know.
I would rather do it now than go back over, because it's so much. I personally I wouldn't want to read the whole thing over again.
I would
translate that daemon as the ego.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how incredibly difficult and almost impossible it seems to overcome the workings of the ego, which is the small life, right? Yeah. The small life, mind, and emotion. Then the normal, quote-unquote, normal human condition.
Yeah. But would Sri Aurobindo describe the ego as a blinded demon, a perverted spirit?
Why not?
I don't know. I never saw him putting things in. Surely he says we should transcend the ego and go beyond that. But and what is this principle of dark and dull inertia? But that came for me as my interpretation, because I see it from my actual experience now. Huh? Someone else could say, oh, anger. This sudden coming up of this boiling up of anger that has been triggered by nothing, right? By someone have just a word can trigger. Huh? This is also something that I think that has something to do with something azuric, by the way. But that's my interpretation. Huh? And when he speaks of the principle of dark and dull inertia, I think he's speaking of the physical here. But there is also the subconscious, which is not only physical, but even something more in the lower plane of our being, and something that's insignificant repetition of the more worthless functionings, needs, cares, occupations, pains, pleasures that lead to nothing beyond themselves. Okay. Some example.
So, John Robert, do you have something to contribute here?
Well, the principle of dark and dull inertia and its base, he says just a little bit farther, this physical mind of inertia. So he identifies it in his own terminology, what that is. It's the physical mind. And the basis of, I mean, kind of the bottom of matter is inertia.
Yeah.
And life obviously has invested itself in matter to survive on this planet. And so life partakes. In fact, when you read the Savitri, you go through those levels. When Ashwapati is doing the traveler of the worlds, his journey, and you go through those life worlds, and the lower ones have lots of inertia in them because they're barely surviving in this material environment. It's different from their life plane. The stronger will of life and the blinded daemon. I think he's talking about universal forces here,
yeah,
that the ego participates in, you know, to the extent that the ego is unbalanced or open in certain ways because it's ignorant and because it separates, thinks it's separate. It participates in these larger universal forces. You know, like we saw in Germany with the Nazis, and we see coming up here in the United States in all these efforts of white supremacy and an attempt to destroy democracy here in favor of an authoritarian figure. So those are universal principles that sometimes find a really good vehicle in a human being.
Yeah.
And I think Sri Aurobindo is talking about them as universal principles. And these are the things that when you're doing yoga, these are the things that you get closer and closer to having to deal with. Because when you do yoga, you kind of, you go in. And when you go in, you find in the inner being, you find both of these, both the light and the dark forces.
Yeah, but I'm also trying to imagine someone who is seeing this now and doesn't know much about Sri Aurobindo. What is a universal force? What is the plane of life? As I understand it, it is that we have not only matter from which lives, because I think we have this scientific paradigm, huh? First, there was matter, and matter has created life. Whereas in this cosmology, so to speak, we have a universal life plane, as there is a universal physical plane, and this universal life plane is entering in the physical plane, is emerging out of the physical plane, but it is not produced, is not generated by the physical plane. And that's, I think, one difficulty that people have sometimes to read Sri Aurobindo. This universal, you know, and the universal life force is a life as a force in itself, which must not necessarily depend on a physical basis. It precedes the physical universe and is trying to enter it and is now reflected in these impulses in our everyday physical bodily life.
I think one of the strongest forces of the material world is inertia.
Yeah.
Right. So overcoming inertia may well be one of the goals of the integral yoga. I'm not sure if I can say that, but that's kind of what comes to me. And that keeps us in the lower planes of consciousness again and again and again, right?
Yeah, well,
that's
why Sri Aurobindo's mother undertook the yoga of the body, of the yoga of the cells, because that's where the greatest difficulty was. Right. And nobody else had succeeded in doing that, at least in a way that was available to the rest of humanity, the way mind is now available to all of humanity, because that force is present in the world as a principle. But the mind has proven unable to master or to transform that inertia, except very partially. You know, I mean, we have this wonderful mind, and it's in this body, so it tells the body what to do, and eventually the body dies. It's not going to do it anymore. So,
you cannot just say, "I don't want to die." Yeah. One decisive point that I think is also about however these principles of dark inertia, we cannot overcome them personally, just through a personal effort. The principle of this yoga is just precisely opposite. Yeah, that of surrender and leave this work to do to a divine or to something, to a higher consciousness. It's not that we have to struggle to, even though, that there's a mixed message now. The personal effort is, especially at the beginning, is initially important, but it must end in a surrender that leaves a higher power to deal with these principles of dark and dull inertia. And then there's something else in this terminology, the physical mind of inertia. So we are saying that the inertia is in matter. So it means that there is a physical mind in matter. So has a stone a physical mind? Mm-hmm. According to Sri Aurobindo, yes.
No? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But this is important, because then we are not speaking about my mind with which I am speaking now. Mm-hmm. We are speaking of something very different when he speaks about physical mind.
So, Marco, what I would like to add to what you are saying is, so the surrender is crucial, right?
Yeah.
The surrender is the centerpiece of the Indigo Yoga. To allow the mother to do the work, her work of transformation. But she's doing that in us, and she is not separate from us. I don't want people to think that there is this above us and we are disconnected from it. That is actually inside of us too.
Yeah.
And Mother and Sri Aurobindo, I believe, what their work was is to open the pathway for us to be able to be in touch with that within us.
Yeah.
It's not just above us, but it is also within us. And for us to become, to surrender ourselves to that within us. I just don't want to get it separated again. Because that was the old ways, is to have the spirit and the body always separated.
Yeah.
Right? That's the whole problem.
And not only spirit and the body, but personal spirit, this ego, which is not personal, it's not spirit, but the ego is here and God is somewhere else. That's what you're talking about. And I think this is a very good point, Andrea, because also very often, one falls back in this idea, the divine or the mother or whatever you might call it, is there, I'm here. And I must hope. No, it's in me. It's me. At the end, we discover that we are that. But it's a very difficult to abolish the separation because it is rooted in our culture also, in our religious culture, right? I mean,
I think the separation is just the crux of the problem. Mm. And it's a falsehood.
Yeah, it's a falsehood.
It's a falsehood. So, you know, the mother manifests in the universe is a manifestation of the divine. That's kind of the concept, right, of Sri Aurobindo, and I totally agree with it. and then I am also a manifestation of the divine. Yeah. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah.
If the universe is a manifestation of the divine, then so am I, and so are you.
Yeah. 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 but one can also put upside down this argument and say, well, but this could be also a nice excuse for the ego to think and do whatever it wants.
Oh, yeah. It's very dangerous.
Yeah. So a spiritual discernment is of paramount importance. Without the spiritual discernment, we would meddle things up.
Yes, the ego is always lurking to catch it and to claim it, to claim everything. That's where the surrender is so central.
And then Aurobindo very often mentions something and then goes on with it or she, he, she, it. It is the soul of human Titanic. Because at some point he says it hates and revolts against higher things.
Mm-hmm.
What is this it? The blinded demon, president, says the very elements that make of life striving.
Yeah, it's the blinded demon, the perverted spirit. Yeah, it says, and the blinded demon is a stronger will of life. This is a very self-willed. I mean, it's like a titan in Indian spiritual thought, or an asura.
Yeah.
I mean, the cosmology is complicated. So, I don't know whether we can go very far to help someone who might be watching this and trying to describe it, because we do have the experience, I think all three of us here probably have the experience of being separate. No, I'm not you. I mean, we have that experience. Sometimes we have the experience, I am you, or we are the same in some really important way. We have the intuition of that. And so we have both of these going on in us. And there's something in us that wants more than what we have, than what we are in our experience of being separate. Following that inner kind of quieter intuition that's not usually not really noisy and going around shouting about it and stuff like that. It's farther in. And so the response or the suggestion of yoga is that we go in to find that and to bring that forward to the extent that we can, because that is our key to moving beyond this state of separation.
Yeah.
But Sri Aurobindo, in this part that we've been reading, he's saying, this is hard work. He says, this is really difficult to do. He's not exaggerating that. He's not saying this is
not a cup of tea,
walk in a park or something. This is really difficult to do. And in some places he says this yoga is difficult. I mean, it's dangerous.
Yeah.
Because we're going outside of the norm of what we are now at this stage and reaching for what we will be, what's calling us from the future.
Yeah.
And what we are in, as they say, in principle, but not in full-blown glory of it. Hardly in the full-blown glory of it. Still, there's something really there that's calling us. And Sri Aurobindo is saying, yes, it is. And here's a way to go there and hear the difficulties, which are significant.
with our
significant... I would like to reflect. It was interesting when you were just talking about that it's very difficult for us to realize that I am you and you are me. And what came to me in that conversation was, because of course that is true and we all feel that. It's like that's impossible, except in moments of grace. So what I was seeing is when I am in the silent soul space, that is the same in you and in you and in everyone. That place of silence, of the silent presence. And then we are all a unique manifestation of that. So we are different in the oneness. We are all different manifestations of the one. That it's not like I am you. In my soul self, you and I are, there's a place where we are that. And that is one. So that's kind of a clarity that came to me. That may be helpful.
In fact, Sri Aurobindo always talks about this unity in diversity.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly. I think it's a principle that we are now pretty much in these recent times we are dealing with that.
Mm-hmm.
We have to see how to manage the individuality and at the same time the collectivity without making emerge contradictions conflicts of interests, one would say today in modern terminology. And that's the big thing that humanity is going through. How can we create an environment where we can express our true nature, inner nature, our soul, our psychic being, and at the same time be in harmony with the interest of a collectivity? Because there's always this egoistic core in us. And as long as that will exist, well, the idea of human unity, as Sri Aurobindo envisaged it, will be pretty difficult. But I think we have to transcend this ego, which, however, means also to create a society or something, a life where I can express myself, my true nature, which is not my ego, but the nature of my psychic being. Because also I think also this idea of psychic beings, they are the spark of the divine, but at the same time these sparks are not all equal to each other. They are all very different. And how can we create a society where every spark of the divine can express itself without making, and that's the great issue that we are more or less subliminally, subconsciously working with today in the world. That's globalism.
Well, it looks to me actually that right now at this time on the planet, the awareness that we are all on this planet together,
yeah,
and that we cannot save one without saving another, that is coming to the, that is alive in the collective consciousness right now, not yeah, in everyone, but it is really present. And so I see an enormous movement in the collective consciousness at this time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it'll take a lot of time and there will be a lot of opposition, but at least there's something moving in that direction. There's an awareness that is growing around the globe.
Yeah, I see that.
You know?
That's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah. You can look at the newspapers every day, or look at the news and see all the opposition. That's what we see in the newspapers. But there's other places you can look, and you can see exactly people talking and expressing the same thing that Andrea is talking about.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's really growing. It's growing in all these different ways that are probably partial. And these, since we're talking about really something that's really a big change for Earth and for humanity, I mean, a really big change. It's very radical. It's far radical, more radical than anything I've seen any politician or a rebel group propose. It's really, it's stunningly radical. So that in this evolutionary world where there's still all these different forces that Sri Aurobindo was talking about, these, the inertia, the physical mind, and the blinded daemon, the stronger will of life, and all those. So it causes all kinds of clashes. And the thing is, when we try to talk about it, we're using English, using a mental language, which is really not up to it. That's why we kind of stumble around with specialized terms or metaphors or saying, well, this and its opposite have to be the same or have to come together some way or another. I mean, it's very crude in our attempts, even though we feel something like that becoming present. And the language for it is not fully here. Although, when you talk about getting close to it, this voice here and the voice of his partner in the work, the mother, I mean, Sri Aurobindo, especially in his poetry, really turns the language inside out and upside down to, so that if you just try to read it from a strategic mind, it makes no sense. But it's there to kind of stretch open the narrowness of our mind so that we can receive in this part of ourselves as well as in our heart part, in our psychic being part.
I would say this part, even yeah. Because this is still mental, no? More intuitive part.
Yeah,
and this, the psychic, of course.
This part can receive that.
Yeah, it is a transducer.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this part of what we have just been reading reminds me a lot of the chapter in Savitri, The Kingdoms of the Little Mind.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, you know, mm-hmm. Where he uses the... Yeah, anyway.
So the difficulty that you're expressing when we started this conversation, Marco, I think is we all find those difficulties, and yeah. And probably anyone who's happens to tune into this will find them too. And Sri Aurobindo does not give short shrift to the difficulties of this work and this transformation.
Right.
He goes full on and says, this is really what it's like.
Yeah. He's not suggesting, oh, you can just overcome that, you know.
Mm-hmm. No, that's not. No. But sometimes I wonder if what I'm reading or what I'm understanding is what he's meaning. Because, you know, it's easy to say, okay, that doesn't relate to me. I am not a blinded demon. I'm not a perverted spirit. What a physical mind of inertia. What? And for example, let me take this last sentence here, Justin, where he says, it hates and revolts against higher things and ameliorating ideal mind and against this ameliorating. But I know a lot of people who I would not at all label as blinded. Yeah, blinded, yes, maybe, but not demons or perverted spirit who are doing precisely that. I just think, for example, of some people in the academia who hate any change and any, and not to, let alone any revolt against higher things, yeah? And it would trample it with fury, yeah? As he says here, tear or crucify any diviner power. But these can be very honest people who really believe that they're on the right side and that they are doing something heroic for the world, for themselves, for the families. So Here, I mean, I don't want to split hairs here, but sometimes it's difficult to discriminate, to discern how to relate what he writes to our everyday experience, because he uses hard words. And one may believe that, well, it could be far away during the times of the Inquisition in the Middle Ages, but I think this is very actual, very present. Point so, is also where and how.
So it's really a collective problem.
Yeah.
In both individual and collective. And everybody participates in it in their particular manifestation, right? With their particular, everybody's doing the best they can. I do believe that. Most everybody is really, and many people are really searching for truth. And they go in a certain path, and it's very valid for the collective too. No. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just that Sri Aurobindo is describing the, you know, the limitations of us being so identified with the physical mind, you know, in the life itself. In the life itself.
But this physical mind is a reactive mind, a mind of nature.
Well, it resists change. It resists change because it wants to keep things the same, as inert, right? Mm. It doesn't want to change because it believes that it is a sole reality.
Yeah, I think to understand it, yes, but sometimes it's difficult to put it into words, but okay.
It is difficult.
Yeah, because there are also things that I think in these 100 years have changed, where he says this idea of the ascetic who wants like to go into some heaven or nirvana. Yeah, there are still some who, but I think the majority of the spiritual movements that we have today have not this idea or not in with this intensity. And so one question, what is then the difference between this yoga and the other path today? And I don't think it is so much the idea of escaping into another heaven, but it is the idea of transforming also other parts of our being. This is the idea of transformation, of a spiritual evolution, of progress. That's still lacking in most of spiritualities. But it's not identified no longer, not so much at least, in this idea of this of a desire into an escape, into a void. It is, I see this very much in this non-dual, you may have noticed now on YouTube and so on, there are a lot of non-dual teachers, and so, in which are quite interesting for in some respect. There's also a lot of it to learn from them, and I appreciate them also. But there's still this idea, well, it's just a mental realization, the abolition of the ego and a retirement in the something inside, and then the rest is only functional to this realization, but does not need more transformation in something that goes beyond that. It is about realizing this transcendent state. And once you have that, you live like in a cinema. Everything happens like on a, it's a huge realization in a certain sense, huge spiritual realization. But they stop there.
Well, as he says. I think what you're pointing to, I see that too, that there is a general desire, I believe, in many spiritual practitioners that we're here to improve life, to make life better for everybody.
Yeah.
It's not the same as divinizing matter.
Yeah.
That's a exactly. whole other leap, yeah. which is where Sri Aurobindo is. That's with the yeah. integral yoga. But I believe that the evolution, the collective evolution, is moving towards yeah. needing and wanting and desiring the life for everyone to improve.
Yeah.
And to dedicate themselves to the saving the earth, for healing people, for creating mm-hmm. better lives for people exactly. all over the planet, which is beautiful.
Beautiful.
And I think it is part of the uplifting of the race.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what I said. That has changed. There's mm-hmm. no longer this idea to escape from the world. There is this idea of changing the world for the better is there now.
It yeah.
definitely is there now. Yeah. But it's still not the same thing that Sri Aurobindo is speaking. No. He is a step ahead. Many steps, not only one step, I think.
He yeah. kicks open every door.
Yeah. And that's the difficulty. You don't know through which door you should go first.
Every one of them needs to get opened.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Now it clarifies a bit.
Well, thank you for bringing, you know, for yeah. putting yourself in here.
Yeah, you know, sometimes not every, but one sentence in two would need a clarification or raises up questions, and it is impossible to do. But sometimes I think it's good to stop at a certain point and say, wait a moment, what is he talking about here? Am I sure that I'm understanding that? And
no, it's good. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, what should we do? Should we proceed a little bit or?
Well, we are over an hour. I think yeah. we should today.
An hour.
In a very full hour.
But I would like to have a chance to read. Before we stop.
You want to read a little more?
I would like to have a chance to read. I haven't read yet.
Ah, yeah, yeah. You're right. Okay.
Oh, dear. Oh, yeah, please.
Right. So, okay. So yeah. you have also quite long paragraphs. So go ahead.
So there's a paragraph that starts on page 172, about two-thirds of the way down, and ends at the bottom of page 173. How about if we stop there?
Yeah, okay.
Unless, of course, Marco or somebody else wants to talk about it.
Oh, I don't know what's about, so let's see. Right.
You're muted, Andrea. You're muted. We can't hear you.
I think that paragraph ends a little sooner in my book. It ends about one-third in the second page.
I don't see that.
It is no solution. So the chapter, the paragraph that you're starting is a remedy, yet there should be, right?
Yes, but in my copy, it ends at the bottom of the page, not in the middle of the page.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Also
Well, then you'll have a lot more than I have. I have an old version. Oh, I'm only on page 162.
Oh, okay.
Okay, I'll pay attention.
A remedy there should be and is a way of redress and a chance of transformation for this troubled vital nature. But for that, the cause of deviation must be found and remedied at the heart of life itself and in its very principle. Since life too is a power of the divine and not a creation of some malignant chance or dark titanic impulse, however obscure or perverted may be its actual appearance. In life itself, there is the seed of its own salvation. It is from the life energy that we must get our leverage. For though there is a saving light in knowledge, a redeeming and transforming force in love, these cannot be effective here unless they secure the consent of life and can use the instrumentation of some delivered energy at its center for a sublimation of the erring human into a divine life force. It is not possible to cut the difficulty by splitting up the works of sacrifice. We cannot escape it by deciding that we shall do only the works of love and knowledge and leave aside the works of will and power, possession and acquisition, production and fruitful expense of capacity, battle and victory and mastery. Striking away from us the larger part of life, because it seems to be made of the very stuff of desire and ego, and therefore doomed to be a field of disharmony and mere conflict and disorder. For the division cannot really be made, or if attempted, it must fail in its essential purpose, since it would isolate us from the total energies of the world power and sterilize an important part of integral nature, just the one force in it that is a necessary instrument in any world creative purpose. The life force is an indispensable intermediary, the effectuating element in nature here. Mind needs its alliance. If the works of mind are not to remain shining inner formations without a body, the spirit needs it to give an outer force and form to its manifested possibilities and arrive at a complete self-expression incarnated in matter. If life refuses the aid of its intermediary energy to the spirit's other workings, or is itself refused, they are likely to be reduced for all the effect they can have here to a static seclusion or a golden impotence. Or if anything is done, it will be a partial irradiation of our action, more subjective than objective, modifying existence perhaps, but without force to change it. Yet, if life brings its forces to the spirit, but unregenerate, a worse result may follow, since it is likely to reduce the spiritual action of love or knowledge to diminished and corrupted motions, or make them accomplices of its own inferior or perverse workings. Life is indispensable to the completeness of the creative spiritual realization. But life released, transformed, uplifted, not the ordinary mentalized human animal life, nor the demonic or titanic, nor even the divine and the undivine mixed together. Whatever may be done by other world shunning or heaven-seeking disciplines, this is the difficult but unavoidable task of the integral yoga. It cannot afford to leave unsolved the problem of the outward works of life. It must find in them their native divinity and ally it firmly and forever to the divinities of love and knowledge.
Yeah, another great chapter. An hour and a half round. Could I comment on this?
I'm very glad you read that. That is just really so to the point and beautiful.
Sri Aurobindo never fails.
Exactly.
He always comes through.
I remember the first time I read through the synthesis of yoga in 1972, how astonished I was that every time a question in me arose, it would be answered in the next paragraph.
Ah, okay.
Unfailing.
Yeah. I have this experience very often as well. Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. What I find very good also is he has this, he uses a bit this Hegelian dialectic. He puts a thesis, an antithesis, and then makes a synthesis. He also already predicts a bit the objection of someone who may read the text. And then, already without hearing the objection, he already answers to it. Yeah.
Yeah, he knows. He knows the human mind inside and out.
Yeah. Okay, if there are no questions or comments, we could close this meeting. Very interesting. Not so much about reading, but nevertheless.
What do you mean? We got three paragraphs today.
Yeah. I wonder when we will finish this. It will go almost 900 pages. We are, well, okay. We have eternity in front of us, don't we?
Exactly.
What's the problem?
Beautiful Tibetan bowl. It sounds terrible on the Zoom. It doesn't do what you... we can't hear what you're hearing.
Let me try it once more right here and see if it makes a difference.
Yeah, it's
not coming across.
Only tongue. That's all.
It's just
it's just going on and on and on and on.
Yeah. And we can't hear that.
But put it nearer to the microphone.
Press it is. There's the microphone.
I've tried everything. Okay.
It's right up there.
That's right. Yeah, it doesn't catch the higher frequencies, probably.
No, Jeffrey and I, the other day, we tried it with my bowl. We tried all kinds of things, and the Zoom is apparently just really geared to the human voice.
Yeah.
That must be it. They cannot transmit the sound of the gong.
Well, I do get some good ones from some of the Zooms. I think Karundas has a, he has a Tibetan bowl.
Yeah.
And it rings on and on the way I was hearing this.
And you can hear it over the Zoom.
Yeah, I can. Mm-hmm. Huh. Of course, I'm using this, but Marco is using his headphones too. So
that
could make a difference.
But if also Andrea doesn't hear it, then it's probably the signal that doesn't come through.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's just have
if you and I hear it, Marco, the signal is coming through, but Andrea's
No, I don't hear
audio.
It.
Oh, you don't.
Marco couldn't hear it.
I hear only talk, and that's only the first half second, and then nothing.
Well, I think you must be right. It's not coming through then.
But Jeffrey has a...
He has it on his iPhone. He has Tibetan bells on his iPhone. Yeah. It works a little bit. It still doesn't sound great, but it works better than this. Yeah.
Okay, eventually.
Anyway, let's just have a moment.
We can use a software that can be integrated and maybe I will
just have a few moments of silence. Yeah.
Good to see you, Marco. Thanks for facilitating, taking care of the recording and everything.
Thank you. Thank you, John Robert, for your also very interesting comments.
Thank you.
There's Andrea back too.
Thank you, Andrea.
Beautiful time together. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.